This is Julia Butterfly Hill with listener-supported radio for Peace International, your global community forum.
This is Scott Fratcher with Allison Thompson for Radio for Peace International. Today, we're going to be airing an interview with Julia Butterfly Hill. Julia Butterfly Hill spoke to Radio for Peace International at SoulFest 2003 in Hopland, California. Julia, you may remember, spent just over 2 years in an ancient redwood tree that she named Luna in an attempt to protect it from the ravages of the chainsaw. Julia today is going to speak to us about what she's done in her life since coming down from that ancient redwood tree, how her life has progressed, and how she is still active in the progressive movement. So stay tuned, for in just a few more minutes we'll be talking to Julia Butterfly Hill. We're honored today to have Julia Butterfly Hill in the studios with us on location in the SoulFest, Northern California. Julia, welcome to the Portable Studio.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
And, in Ecuador just recently, you had a small, I guess what you would call, event. Would you like to talk about that and comment on it?
Well, I get asked to help communities around the world, and I always try and find where I feel I can best help because I get more requests than I can do. And in Ecuador, I had been involved with support organizations from the United States in Ecuador and Colombia for a while, and had been getting requests to go, but not quite sure of, I was waiting for the time to be really clear of this is how I can help the most. And so I found out that these residents of Mindo, which is an area where the beautiful cloud rainforest is that's being decimated by the Osepe Occidental Petroleum Pipeline, is going through, and that the residents, the young people, actually started tree sits when they heard about the tree sit in California that I was involved in, because they're trying everything they know to stand up against a very corrupt and destructive system. So when I heard that, I was like, there's the connection I need, because I know I'm always looking for how can I best leverage an issue? How can I best help take something to the next level in a good way? And so when I heard they had done that, I knew then that I might be able to help them with media. And so because they were now doing an action similar to mine, and because of that, I could try and help leverage mainstream media for them. So I agreed to go to Ecuador and work with various groups, and I ended up working with four different NGO groups in Ecuador and two support groups from America that I went down there with. And those four NGOs in Ecuador represent, I believe it was like 11 or 12 different tribes of indigenous people from Ecuador. And we did a tour where we toured beautiful areas that have not yet been devastated. We toured areas that are the toxic legacy of Chevron, Texaco, and who were some of the original infrastructure builders of the pipeline. And then we toured places that are marked to be destroyed by the new pipeline being laid. And we went with video cameras and photographs and microphones just like this, and recorded and documented what was happening to the place and to the people. And I ended up on what was supposed to be my last day in Ecuador doing an action at the Occidental Oil Petroleum headquarters in Quito. And they were supposed to, they had agreed to a meeting with myself and six other people representing the four different NGOs, the two from America and the 12 different tribes. And they had agreed to the meeting, but when we got there, they refused and said they would only meet with me. And I said, the fact that they would even say that they would only meet with me, was proof of how completely disrespectful they are of the people in the place. Because how could I speak their story better than they can? And how dare Occidental Petroleum offices refuse to allow them the opportunity to tell what's happening to their lives? And when Occidental refused to keep its promise, we shut them down, and we shut their headquarters down in Quito in totally peaceful protest. But then the military police and immigration police showed up and got violent. And I ended up getting arrested, not on the protest line shutting down the building, but actually they came and they just, without warning, without any sign at all, they began violently pulling people. What I ended up getting arrested when they pulled a 16-year-old boy who had long hair. They pulled him off the ground because we were sitting down in front of all the doorways. That's how we shut it down. And they picked him off the ground by his hair and then threw their arms around his neck and started choking him. And I jumped up and said, Pacifico, Pacifico, peaceful, peaceful, and ended up getting him free. And I ended up getting arrested, which was the very best thing that could have happened, because the mainstream corporate media is not interested in a story unless there's some form of sensationalism. And the minute I got arrested, the mainstream media all over the world, who we had already reached out to and tried to get them to cover the fact that I was even there and cover the story, and they wouldn't do it. The minute I was arrested, it hit the newswire, AP, Reuters, everything, and went all over the world and ended up highlighting the struggle of these people who live in areas that are out of sight, out of mind, so to say. And over half of the oil in Ecuador is being exported to California. And so it was so important for me as a citizen of the United States, as someone who's based in California, to get people to become aware of the fact that when we voted down better gas mileage for SUVs, we voted for the devastation of very real people. Blood and flesh. These are real people whose lives are being devastated in a real place. So that's why I ended up going there, was to try and help put the faces and the places on the petroleum industry complex.
Because of who you have become, because of your famous time in the trees, you're able to affect and generate media and to any issue that you lend your energy to. I think I've heard you say that that's what you're intending to do, or what you are doing is lending your energy to different causes that people solicit your help for. Talk about some of the other causes internationally that you've been involved in.
Let's see. I'm in Italy. I was involved with a grassroots movement of people who were working to get the Italian parliament to protect 13 different species of trees as historical landmarks. And we won that. I went, they were almost to the point where the vote was going to happen. And they were hoping for that extra boost. And so when I came, it helped them get that extra boost in the media, which thereby spread it to a far enough level of people who then were successful in pressuring the Italian parliament to pass this law. Working a lot there around how the cities were not designed for a car culture. And as car culture is infesting countries in Europe, like Italy and other countries, it's destroying parks and trees and natural spaces that exist within the cities, because the roads are very narrow and it's not based on a car culture. It's based on walking and bicycling the squares. It's all about interacting, and car culture is about disconnecting. So I've done quite a bit of work in Italy around that. In Canada, I was just in Canada working with the First Nations people of an area known as Grassy Narrows. It's an area where the indigenous peoples were pushed off of their first land and told by the government, basically, you have to move, but pretending as if you'll move, we will offer your children better educational services and we'll give you a better wastewater and water access system. So they were pretty much forced to move with a promise attached to make it seem as if the government was being nice. So they moved off of their traditional lands. They were originally a hunter-gatherer tribe anyway, so they were a migrating tribe. And they were pushed from this one spot they had already been shoved onto into another spot. And they're subsistence tribes, so they live off of things they gather from the forest and from the rivers. They live off of fish and animals from the forest and nuts and berries and things like that from the forest. And after they had been in this new spot for a few years, there started to become this very scary disease coming out in their community, where people were basically having what appeared like muscular dystrophy, where their muscle systems and their neural systems began shutting down. And after testing, they found out that where they had been moved to, all the fish had high levels of mercury from a pulp mill that was international Weyerhaeuser pulp mill that was releasing mercury, which is used in the pulping process, into the water, which bioaccumulated in the fish. And then these people who live subsistence with the land were now getting mercury poisoning. So now they can no longer eat the fish. The government never stepped up the educational services, like they said. Their form of water cleanup was to now give them a filter that uses chlorine to clean up the mercury-contaminated water, as if that works. And now they gave a contract to a logging company to go in and log the forest. So these are people who live off the water and off the forest who now can no longer live off the water, and the government gave the right for this company to go in and log. So I went there and did a whole bunch of – it's outside of Winnipeg, and I went to Toronto and did some community organizing and educating in Toronto, trying to build the support mechanisms they need to fight the system, and then went out to the actual blockade where they're shutting down roads to their ancestral lands and did some support work out there. So the issues are broad, and I just try and really find places where I think that offering the services that I have can help a community, that it could turn the tides.
And that was a question I was going to ask. At what point in a project is it valuable, or, you know, have you deemed it valuable for you to arrive? When can you make a difference? When is that tide turning point?
I think pretty much, I would say about 99.9% of the requests I get are all important, are all valuable, are all relevant, are all crucial, vital, and you name it, right? And so, yeah, so for me, I look at a lot of different things, including that I don't go to any one region for just one event, because I recognize that I'm taking from the earth every time I travel. So I'm not going to go to one region for one event, because I'm going to take more than I'm going to give back. So part of my decision process happens around bioregionalism and looking in a region of where the requests are coming in and trying to, it's almost like putting a puzzle together. Mm-hmm. Another thing I have to look at is that I'm an activist in a nonprofit, and a lot of people think because I've written books and because I'm in the media that equates money, but it doesn't. So I have to factor in how much is the travel expenses and trying to build what we call anchor dates that cover the travel expenses and pay some form of an honorarium so that the nonprofit work can continue, so that I can do all the pro bono work. Part of what I take into consideration is, if the group that's contacting me is a group who's working in collaborative model or competition model. And I'm really trying to find the groups who are interested in collaborative participation and not competition. So I get a lot of requests from people, and in doing the research around them, find that they typically work more as an isolated unit. And then I encourage them, instead of saying yes to my coming, I actually say yes by saying, these are four other organizations you should be reaching out to. And I know that if they're really committed to doing the work, they're going to do that first. And if they do that, and I don't say, if you do this, then I'll come. I just say, I can't come right now, but you should do this. And sometimes they take me up on it and it ends up working really well. And other people are like, they're not ready to go collaborative model yet. And in either case, I know that it's not right for me to be there yet. So those are some of the many things that we take into consideration when trying to decide where to go and how to help.
And can you talk about the importance of media, progressive media, alternative voices on radio, because that's what we're on right now, and how you feel about that?
I've had a lot of experience with media now. And I never knew I was going to have a lot of experience with media. And I learned the hard way, because I actually was not raised in media culture. My family never had a television. We were not really exposed to media culture. And so a lot of my learning happened through my experience in the tree. So I kind of dove into the deep end on more than one level, including around media. And I witnessed how corporate mainstream media took my story and the 2 hours I would give with their interviewers and how they would edit it. And I started calling corporate mainstream media the beast, because in the editing room, it takes everything that's really vital and important and chews it up. And what it spits out the other side is nothing like the real truth of what's going on. And then bearing witness then to the media that I was interacting with that was people powered, that was community powered, that was non-corporate funded, and seeing the profound difference with the same story and how it was articulated. And so in that is where I found that these forms of people powered communication is so vital, because corporate mainstream media is not only not informing, it's misinforming. It's one thing not to inform someone, it's a whole other level of kind of ingrained evilness, if you say it that way, you know, and a knowing of how to misinform people as a way to get them to do what you want. So for me, these supporting people power communication is so vital, because it's not only about giving people the information, but it's also about re-educating a public that has been grossly misinformed.
So since you're successful tree sit, as they say, there are many more people that are considering following that model. And what do you have to say to the potential tree sitters?
The first thing that's important for people to realize is I'm not the first tree sitter. You know, tree sitting came to America as a form of protest from England well over 15 years ago. So I actually stepped into a very long and rich history of activism in the trees. And I'm most known for it because most of the time people would stay for a few days to a week and then take turns rotating in and out. But I would not have been able to do the action I did if I wasn't stepping into a history of activism where people had been tilling the soil, so to speak, and nurturing that soil and creating an environment that would support someone like me taking the action I took. So I'm most known for it, but I'm relatively new in the history of tree sitting. And so I always encourage people to... I became an activist without any training at all, and luckily I had a lot of angels watching over me. But I encourage people to take a little bit of training, and I really support groups like the Ruckus Society that actually does trainings for people who are interested in doing direct action. And I think it's so crucial because I've been in actions where it's very obvious who's gone through training and who hasn't. Because if you take the time to go through some training in direct action, there's always variables that you don't know what's going to happen. And the more training you have, the more prepared you are to deal with the surprises. And those surprises sometimes can be very intense, like when a police officer has a gun pointed to your head or pepper spray is being sprayed. Like if you've gone through training, you know you have coping mechanisms on how not to panic in that situation. But if you haven't had training, we're animals. So animals' response is fight or flight. So your immediate response to pepper spray is fight or flight in an animalistic response. Whereas if you have training, you know there's another way that you can drop down. There's various tools you can use to deal when pepper spray is being shot or tear gas is being shot. So it's the tools vary, but there are numerous organizations, and of Ruckus is being one of the ones I really support and believe in the most, because they do trainings on how to use technology just like we're using as activists. What we're using right now to do this interview, they do technology trainings. They do direct action trainings. They put you through. They actually make you act out various situations, and sometimes they make you act like the aggressor so that it actually helps you find a place of empathy when someone might be threatening violence to you or trying to perpetuate violence against you. So that's actually what I encourage people. But I also encourage people, don't let your belief that you don't know enough or have enough resources ever stop you, because who we are is who we're meant to be. And I didn't have training and I didn't have information, but I had enough to know that what was happening was wrong and I needed to be involved in changing it.
Hi, my name is John Schaefer. I'm the president and founder of Real Goods and of the Solar Living Institute. I'm a great supporter of Radio for Peace International and the Global Community Forum.
Listening to an interview with Julia Butterfly Hill by Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson for Radio for Peace International, broadcasting from El Rodeo, Costa Rica. Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson are both graduates of the IPC, the Institute for Progressive Communication, courses taught at the grounds of Radio for Peace International in Costa Rica, just 1 hour west of the capital of San Jose. If you would like to find out more information about Radio for Peace International or the Institute for Progressive Communications, log on to our website at www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org. And now, stay tuned for more Julia Butterfly Hill.
Hi, my name is Michael Carrera with the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and we support Radio for Peace International.
Well, that brings up another subject then. There's quite a few people who are just waking up to the world as it is and the politics that got us here, and they seem to wake up, and oftentimes they look around, then they see the whole picture and everything that's wrong, and then they feel overwhelmed. And what do you have to say to those people of how they can move into making a change?
What I tell people is to realize that every single day we make choices, and because no choice is made in a vacuum, every choice changes the world. And the struggle is that so often we don't see the immediate results that we think we're powerless. But my generation has inherited the consequences of the choices of some people who aren't even here anymore. And some of those consequences are just now coming about after those people are long gone. So those people didn't see the results of their choices that I'm now living with. And the generations who are up and coming under me are living with, or in some cases dying with, the consequences of choices that are being made today. And so it's really hard, especially in privileged culture where we're so disconnected from our choices. I use the example of, we talk about throwing something away. Where is away? Where is away? And we say it, and it's, our words are very powerful magnifying glasses of our consciousness. And we think there's some away. But where away is predominantly marginalized and oppressed communities, traditionally communities of color. Now we're starting in this country, in America, we're now shipping our away to other countries, and they actually are getting paid to store our away. And so they're based their economy on allowing us to pollute them. And in this country, in America, it's people who live in cities like Oakland in California. You know, California is known for San Francisco and Berkeley. But Oakland is the away of our consciousness in California. So it's really important for people to get that just because they don't see the results does not mean they're not changing the world, because every choice changes the world. And so I encourage people to look at it as one of two things. We can either be unconscious, destructive change agents, or we can be conscious healing agents. And it's up to us, from what we put on our forks and our plates, what kind of food we're eating, where it's coming from, if the earth or people have been exploited for us to get that cheap food that looks really pretty that comes in a package, or if we're willing to have a couple of bruises and nibbles on it because it's organic and we didn't pollute the earth, we didn't pollute farmers, and we're willing to pay a little more because we realize that real cost, like things that are cheap, aren't, they're not being based on real cost. They're not, what it's actually costing the planet and the people is not being factored into the price you pay at the cash register. So there's so many ways, whether it's getting out in your community and finding out needs of your community. There's, I talk a lot about our elders. Like I hung a sign from Luna that said, respect your elders, because we don't respect our elder trees. But in many societies, we don't respect our elder people anymore either. It's like, put them out of sight, out of mind, put them away. So there's so many ways that people can change the world. And if you take one step and choose a step that you know is an accomplishable goal, when you accomplish it, it's like you get that feeling again of, oh yeah, I make a difference. And that's the fuel that can then encourage you to take the choices that you know you might not see the results of in your lifetime, but that doesn't mean you're not making change.
At the beginning, in the first few days of the current Gulf War, there were many unpopular things that corporations and governments did, and one of them was the pulling the tree sitters down from different trees in the Pacific Northwest. And do you have any comment on that and the timing?
There has been, including when I was in the tree, a very concerted effort to get tree sitters down. I mean, when I was in the tree, they tried starving me down, sleep depriving me down, blowing me out with a helicopter, cutting trees directly at the tree I was in, hitting the tree I was in with other trees, trying to get me down. It's not like they just picked a moment to do it. But part of what I saw happening was they kind of wait, and it's almost like I realized in my dealing with the CEO of Maxam Corporation, which is the corporation I began protesting, it's almost like a chess game. And they're very strategically looking at when to move a pawn and who that pawn is. And usually in a corporation, it's their workers. And then when to move the queen to a specific position. So it's very much like a chess game. And a lot of it is a bet, but they have people who are paid to bet on that chess game and to move those pieces in a very strategic way. So I think a lot of what was happening around the tree sits as well was there was a surge in efforts of support. Remedy was coming very close to having spent a year in the tree. And they knew from interacting with me that that kind of a in a culture that's addicted to numbers and records and anniversaries and things like that, that for her to reach that mark would resurge the support. And so I think there was a very concerted effort to stop that energy while it was coming. And unfortunately, in many ways, they were right. Because so often, one of the things I talk to people about is that we have to do what we do regardless of the outcome. We need to do it because what else would we want to do with our lives? And when we're attached to the outcome, when something like that happens, it stops us in our tracks. And instead, it should have just fueled the movement even more. It should have, the audacity of the way in which they risked those activists' life getting them down, because some of the ways they took activists down was extremely dangerous. The audacity of a company that would treat people like that, let alone what they're doing to the planet, should have been a fuel to surge a whole new layer of people. And it happened, but only for a short time, and then the energy dissipated. And so there's, the forests still need people's help. And part of what I am constantly trying to do is say that I don't want to live in a world of leaders and followers. I want to live in a world of leaders and leaders and leaders. And you can look at any movement throughout history that's been based on one leader, and when something happens to that leader, that movement falls apart. And so I think it's so vital that, including with things like tree sitting, and including with like what's happening around dropping bombs on innocent people in places like Iraq, to me it's there's so many approaches to stopping it, including stop getting in your car so much. Carpool, take public transportation, walk, ride your bike, be in the streets every chance you have. If you have the opportunity to go to centers of government, go there and speak out and be a presence, and don't stop. We're almost addicted to, we want to have our big march in the street with 50,000 people and go home and say we've done it. And it took me 2 years and 8 days. In that tree. It didn't take me one day. It was 2 years and 8 days of one day after another after another. And I think that that's really crucial as we talk about whatever strategies governments or corporations are using. We have to realize that one of our strongest strategies is our refusal to give up, and that we have to be that constant presence over time.
Have you been following the carbon trade the carbon deposit trading programs, and what do you think of those?
I have been involved in them for a while on many different fronts, and there's both a fabulous strength in carbon offset trading, and there's an intense weakness. And so I'm about closing the loopholes that would support the weakness and supporting the strengths. And what I mean by that is that right now there's so many loopholes in place that basically you can grow trees for 10 years and cut them down and then still be a part of carbon trading. And that's not a good form. I'm not into polluting at all. But the reality is, as long as we're polluting, we ought to be investing in ways of cleaning our pollution up as we work towards a non-polluting society. And I'm a real advocate of it, because I've had a lot of people attack me, but I'm like, I'll be at an event and they'll attack me for talking about it as a dual approach in cleaning up our system. And I'm like, how did you get here? And they stop. How did you get here? I drove in a car. Okay, did your car pollute? Yes, you ought to be offsetting your carbons then. And until you do, you better not attack me, you know? So I've been doing it. Every time I've ever traveled, anytime I've gotten an honorarium, I've put funds away towards carbon offsetting that I've used to donate to groups who are working on protecting old growth forests and wetlands, because they're the two largest stores of carbon on our planet. So I'm all about protecting old growth and wetlands. And if I can get money from polluters to do that, without there being loopholes that allow them to basically greenwash themselves. And there is a greenwashing component of carbon offset trading that's very destructive and dangerous. But there's also a core commitment of change that's happening. And what's really exciting is right now, who's doing it are musicians. There's a really famous group in the United States called Coldplay that, of their own initiative, started working with it's a forest... Future Forest, I think, might be their name, although I'm not positive. And they offset the carbons they create by going on tour. They take percentages of their CDs sales and their record sales and their touring sales and donate it to offset their own carbons. So that's like that. They're recognizing that they're a polluter, and they're recognizing that as a polluter, until a cleaner system becomes available to them to travel, that as long as they're traveling, they're going to offset their carbons. Any question that people have, I direct them to my nonprofit Circle of Life. CircleofLife.org. And the reason I do is because I started that nonprofit with the mission of helping people connect with what's already going on in the world. We don't reinvent the wheel. We don't try and do a program that someone else is doing. We just take all those questions and all that energy, and we act like a portal in the middle of the wheel, and we just direct it back out. So whether it's about force, whether it's about direct action, whether it's a teacher who feels like she doesn't have the curriculum or he has the curriculum that he or she needs in their classroom, if it's a business person wanting to step up their sustainability in their operations, as long as they're not a corporation, a large corporation, we don't work with them. But we do work with small corporations. Then they can contact Circle of Life. And our mission is to help support them in getting what they need to take their activism to another level.
Can you spell your website?
Sure. Our website is Circle of Life, as in the Circle of Life we're all a part of, .org. And that's spelled CIRCLEOFLIFE.org.
Would you talk about your upcoming tour?
So my upcoming tour is called We the Planet. And that name came to me because there's this whole part of my goal is to dissolve the illusion of separation that says we're separate from each other, we're separate from the earth, we're separate from the animals. Whatever the separateness is, I'm all about dissolving that illusion. And so the name We the Planet came up to me as a way of speaking that. It's incredible how many people, especially in the United States, say, we the people, because we're like programmed of it's all about the people. And so I'm like, no, it's we the planet. There's so much, we're just another species on this planet. And if we don't get that, our time as a species here is very limited. And so We the Planet is about modeling solutions on every level of production. We are taking a bus across the country that's powered by vegetable oil, and we're using well-known celebrities from the United States to draw in the unusual suspects who see them as cool, who see them as their icon of whatever is hip and interesting of the current times. And we are all about the solution. So we are going into communities that are really devastated with a lot of problems facing them, but we are coming from a solution model and helping people realize all the solutions that exist within their communities, within their lives, and within their world. And it'll be a month-long tour, beginning in Colorado, ending up on the East Coast, and then having a final close-off in California in November. And it's going to be really incredible. It's really coming together in a very powerful way.
I wanted to just ask one more thing, and I don't know if we might not run this with a program, but at Radio for Peace International right now, we are facing a lockout. The University for Peace is asking Radio for Peace to remove itself from buildings that were constructed with listener-sponsored funds. And at this point, we've built a platform in the tower.
Why are they asking you to do that?
Probably our anti-globalist stance.
We play a lot of Pacifica programming and all progressive programming.
And wouldn't a University for Peace be about progressive stuff?
The University for Peace is the United Nations University for Peace. And these two organizations have been working together side by side on land that was granted by the Costa Rican government to the United Nations for the purpose of the University for Peace, who then allowed and Radio for Peace to operate business. As we have been facing this lockout, we've been attempting to get our media attention and figure out how to at least get a fair deal if that is the end product of what we have to do. And we've been thinking about you, and we've been thinking about tower sitting, if that's mm-hmm. what it comes to get enough media attention to get a fair relocation deal. We've had an excellent program of letter writing to Kofi Annan at the United Nations, and we have heard that our voices have been heard, but negotiations are ongoing until October 31st. My question is, do you have any advice, recommendations for tower sitters?
Hi, my name is Jim Bennett from KPFA in Berkeley, and I'm a supporter of Radio for Peace International, which is the progressive voice on shortwave.
Yeah.
You are listening to an interview with Julia Butterfly Hill by Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson for Radio for Peace International, broadcasting from El Rodeo, Costa Rica. Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson are both graduates of the IPC, the Institute for Progressive Communication, courses taught at the grounds of Radio for Peace International in Costa Rica, just 1 hour west of the capital of San Jose. If you would like to find out more information about Radio for Peace International or the Institute for Progressive Communications, log on to our website at www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org. And now, stay tuned for more Julia Butterfly Hill.
Hi, I'm Gus Newport of radio station KPFA FM, and I'm a supporter, listener, friend of Radio for Peace International, the people's voice.
Let's see, what's the beautiful thing about the micro radio station is, too, you can create a tower anywhere you want as well. We actually had talked about doing it up in Luna, but there was so much media already coming my way that I was just like, I don't think it's a... it's a necessary place to have it, you know. But like in Berkeley, they did free radio in the trees. And in San Francisco, they did free radio in the trees. Like they just set up platforms in the trees and started broadcasting. So the beautiful thing is that you can kind of take this form of technology in many, many places. The biggest key is to make sure that you have support systems in place of people who are paying attention. Because in the beginning when I was in the trees, no one was paying attention and the company tried to kill me. And then when people started paying attention, the company said, oh, we're just going to ignore her. Eventually she'll come down. And then when I didn't come down and enough more people paid attention and got involved, then the company agreed to protect the area. So it wasn't a solo effort. It was a team effort. So that's a really important part. Like you have this support. You're building the support. Make sure that... You're thinking of ways that people can proactively support you if you take that position.
There's a three-pronged triangle that's happening in that region right now. That is one, the shutdown of this international shortwave radio broadcast. We reach a pretty large audience and present a different face of America to international listeners. We are on the same bandwaves as Voice of America and Christian Broadcast Radio, and I think it's really important to keep a progressive alternative voice on the air so that people around the world know that not all Americans are represented by Voice of America, Christian Broadcasting. There's also, are you familiar with the ILEA? It's a police training academy. It's similar to the School of the Americas, although they have stated in the literature that they are not. Although we're often mistaken for the School of Americas, we are not. I think that the ILEA is looking for a location in Costa Rica right now, and I think they're considering the University for Peace campus to locate themselves.
What is the support or non-support like from the Costa Rican government?
There's a lot of organized activist Costa Ricans that are protesting the location or the location of the ILEA in Costa Rica. The government, the president of Costa Rica, and the minister of foreign relations are both interested in the Radio for Peace lockout and what's going on.
Okay, now we're going to take a few questions from our listening audience, if we may.
Since 1997, things have changed a lot in the activities and attitudes of Earth First North Coast. Shunka, one of your best friends, who is pretty much engaged there for a couple of years, told us. How is your relationship to Earth First today, and are you still in contact with Pacific Lumber Company?
I have always had really good relationships with people within Earth First. Earth First is actually a global movement, and it's different everywhere you go, and the people that are involved in it are different everywhere you go. So to say you kind of relate to the movement is a whole other thing as saying you relate to the people. So over the years, I've continued to work with people who are involved representing Earth First movement. And So, and that's been all over the world. It's the face of it and the way they act and everything is different every community you go into. And as far as with Pacific Lumber, I have continued to remain involved. The biggest work I've been doing in California is working on an initiative that we actually got through the Senate and are now trying to get through the Assembly that would protect any tree that's been in California that was standing here before it gained statehood, which is like 1850, something right around there. Any tree that's been standing since before California gained statehood would be protected under this law. So I was one of the original funders of that initiative process. I've been the main fundraiser for the initiative. I've been working on lobbying in Sacramento. I mean, nonstop. So that's the way I found that my next stage of trying to help in the forests is by working on the legislative angle. And in Pacific Lumber in general, they have been very clearly doing what I knew they were going to do because I come from a business background. And so I said, you just watch, this company, corporation is going to come in, and other people were saying it too. They're going to come in, they're going to liquidate the assets, whether it's trees or mills or workers. They're going to take everything they can from it, and then they're going to bankrupt the company and leave. And that's currently what they're doing. They just, they last year fired 100% of their loggers, and they contract out to other companies. And the result is they don't have to pay their workers benefits. They don't have to pay them insurance. They don't have to pay them seniority. They don't have to anything. It's just a contract. And if the contractor violates the laws, Pacific Lumber can say, we didn't do it. The contractor did it. So that was their first step. And then their second step was to shut down their mill that's specifically set up only to log old growth trees. And now what they're doing is trying to get to all the trees that aren't currently held up in lawsuits to get them out. And Maxam Corporation split Pacific Lumber into more than one company, and it put the debt into one of those companies so that it can take all of the money from all the other companies and leave one. It's still Pacific Lumber, but he split it into four. And so he put all the debt into one. He'll take all the money from the other three and leave the debt with the one and bankrupt the company. So that's where he's headed.
Cutting Luna for two-thirds, the culprit hurt you personally deeply too. But not only concerning to Luna, you are a personality of intensive feelings. How do you handle those moments of deep pain, fear, or rage?
It's been a really powerful teacher for me because the human side of me wants to have a chance to just handle it. You know, I'm like, the spotlight on me has been powerful because I can use it to shine it on all the issues that are so important. But the flip side of that is that it's very painful because it creates this culture that dehumanizes a person. People forget to relate to me as a person. They relate to me as an icon. They relate to me as a celebrity. They relate to me as the tree sitter. They don't relate to me as a person anymore. I'm like a story. And the result of that is that I do go through things just like anyone else, but it's really hard because I'm not allowed the space to deal with it in a human way that other people are afforded. And so it has been really difficult. I never felt rage around Luna's cut because all I saw was the incredible amount of fear in the person who cut that tree. The tree can't run away. The tree can't defend itself. And it was protected under an agreement that all sides agreed to. And so to me, I knew that Luna was attacked because Luna is a symbol. And symbols are always attacked because of people's rage and fear. And rage is usually a result of fear. So I just saw the person who attacked Luna, I saw their fear so clearly that I didn't even need to rage. And I actually, one of the things I did was I sent out a communication via the internet that said, allow this person's rage to take the place of everyone else's. I was asking people, don't respond to this attack in rage. Allow, this person has enough rage for us all. And I saw in the cut in Luna the wound of our world. Because that wound disconnects Luna from the roots. And that same wound exists within our world. We're being disconnected from our roots. And the way to reconnect is not through further anger or rage, but it's through love and it's through healing and it's through commitment. So the challenge was trying to process that without a chance to process. So it's like I'm processing while the cameras and the microphones are on. And it's like, woo, it's intense, you know? But the beautiful thing is that I constantly hear expressed over and over again is that people are appreciative of the fact that I'm willing to just go through it with them. Because my goal is to get rid of that myth that I'm a superhero or a celebrity or an other, whatever that other is. And so when I'm willing to go through the difficult stuff with people, it helps them realize that I'm not an other, that I'm just another person. And so that's a good thing that I try and hold on to when I sometimes want to be like, can I not just do this myself? And people ask me, are you going to go live in a tree again? And I always tell them, yes, but this time I'm not telling any of you where I'm going. I'm not going to bring a mic, or I'm not going to bring a phone or a radio or anything. I'm just going to go and hide for a while.
Thank you for being on the program, Julia.
Absolutely. Good luck staying on the air.
Hi, this is Larry Bensky from Sunday Salon at radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California. I support Radio for Peace International.
You've been listening to an interview with Julie Butterfly Hill, taken by Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson. Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson are both graduates of the Institute for Progressive Communications, taught at the grounds of Radio for Peace in El Rodeo, Costa Rica, 1 hour west of San Jose, Costa Rica, the capital. To find out more about the Institute for Progressive Communications, log on to our website, www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org. Radio for Peace International would like to thank the organizers of SoulFest 2003 for their help in setting up these interviews and the recording of many of the speeches that the listeners of Radio for Peace International have been able to enjoy in the previous few weeks. So thank you for all the help to the organizers of SoulFest 2003.
Hi, this is Betty Biodiesel, and you're tuned to listener-supported Radio for Peace International, your global community forum.